Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. I apologize to you for having kept you waiting, but it's all my fault. The morning proceeding didn't end until 12:40, and then I had an appointment with the budget office at 12:15, which obviously I was not able to keep until about 1, and that extended to this time. So my apologies to you and to the entire court. We have, as our last argument in January and today, 2005 AP 1281D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Michael W. Tobin. Mr. Weigel, you have 25 minutes, and I am aware that neither side asked for oral argument, and to that extent, we apologize to you if it's taking more of your time than you originally requested. Mr. Weigel.
Thank you, Chief Justice and Justices. Good afternoon. I am Bill Weigel. I'm representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation. Although perhaps the argument wasn't requested, the OLR absolutely did file an appeal from the referee's sanction recommendation. And the opportunity to discuss these issues with you personally is very much appreciated. I plan to begin with some background, talk about precedent, and discuss why some of what Attorney Tobin may proffer should not sway you. The OLR filed a 10-count disciplinary complaint. Actually, it was an amended complaint that contained the 10 counts, and of course those 10 counts were filed because your preliminary review committee had found cause to proceed as to those. Although the parties filed a pretty extensive pretrial partial stipulation of facts, a stipulation that was incorporated within and is made a part of the referee's report, the matter nevertheless proceeded to trial for 2 days. I think there were some 15 witnesses, there were 46 exhibits received, and your referee found that the OLR had proven clearly, convincingly, and satisfactorily 9 of the misconduct counts. As to the one unproven count, the evidence and counter-evidence was described by the referee as not simply complex, but convoluted and confusing, and that description is not inapt. OLR chose not to appeal on that count, and that count, at most, as admitted in our brief, was really a technical or de minimis violation. So that's a matter that we don't have to worry about today. Another issue that should not be in dispute today is Attorney Tobin's commission of the 9 remaining misconduct counts. There was no cross-appeal taken as to any of those 9 counts. And those 9 remaining counts, or at least 8 of the 9, are really anything but de minimis. And that's what brings us here, because it is the very serious nature of Attorney Tobin's misconduct that caused the OLR director to determine that it was necessary to appeal from the referee's suggestion that 120-day suspension was appropriate.
And what's the suspension you recommend?
2 years.
And that's what you're recommending here on appeal to?
That is what the OLR director has consistently sought in this action. I guess a good way to put that, Chief, if I may, is that the OLR director requested, and the OLR requested a 2-year suspension. We believe that that request and recommendation is in line with precedent. We quite frankly appealed because the referee's recommendation was not even of a length that would require this respondent to petition for reinstatement.
It's my understanding that Mr. Tobin's position is it should be a public reprimand or what is it, 60 days? Is that his position?
My understanding is that he had requested a public reprimand or a lesser period of suspension.
Okay, 90 days. 90 days, right. All right.
The nature of Attorney Tobin's conduct, Chief Justice, merits a more severe disciplinary response. And on the issue of sanction, and you well know this, but the ball is in your court, court. I mean, it's a sanction is within your prerogative, and you owe no deference to this referee's suggestion as to sanction. It's very important, you know, when you sit back there and you decide what this case should say, and you vote on that, to consider all of what Attorney Tobin has proven to have done.
Counselor, I'm interested in knowing whether the amount of the amount in issue for these violations, which is approximately $10,000 when you add them together, is a big factor, a little factor, or no factor in your recommendation.
It is a factor. There are cases which the OLR has distinguished saying, well, that was a $300 conversion, or this guy was out of trust by $20. That's why they were reprimanded. $10,000 is not an insignificant sum of money. The amount of the sanction isn't quantifiable mathematically, you know, proportionally to the amount that a person is alleged to have taken. I guess what I do want to say specifically on that issue, however, is that Mr. Tobin has argued, well, I processed 70,000 checks involving hundreds of millions of dollars, and this is only a $10,000 matter. You know, proportionally, it's some kind of a drop in the bucket. I guess I would characterize that as saying maybe the critical mass of what Attorney Tobin did properly should somehow outweigh what he did in these instances, these multiple instances. This is three separate accounts, three separate closures, conversions, dishonest conversions. And that's not how misconduct is assessed, just as it isn't assessed mathematically. A lot of rights don't somehow negate very serious wrongs.
Well, is this an unusual case? When I read this briefs, I'm only relating to my 15 years on the court approximately, where a person has had this much business and he was basically a closing attorney, if I understand it. You know, and the money that was taken or converted to his own benefit were monies that were held in trust for people that may or may not have known that they had money coming, and he didn't adequately try to contact those people, right? He did not. That's what I understood the referee found, that he said that there was no serious effort made to contact.
That is what led to the money being there for him to convert.
Right.
Yes. I guess to recharacterize, if I might, and I don't want to misrepresent your question, but is there an argument there, well, Mike Tobin says, I didn't take client money? Well, except perhaps in one matter that I think did involve clients, you know, that's accurate.
Mm-hmm.
But he took money that he knew did not belong to him. And when we're talking about money held in an attorney's trust account, whether that belonged to a client or a third party is a distinction really without a difference. And I think that the argument can certainly be made that if these people don't know that their money is being converted, they are more vulnerable than the client who knows and expects and is tracking the money contemporaneously. He did the right things at the get-go, at the closing. He did not steal money from closings and try to pay himself. This is with regard to monies that were held in several of his trust accounts that he knew to whom the funds were originally payable. He knew that they were not his funds, and he made the choice to take that money. And as we traced through, and there was some ballyhoo about my use of the phrase follow the money, but on one day he closes an account, writes a check payable to himself, takes that check, puts it in the business account. It goes out of the business account. The money goes into the payroll account. From the payroll account, the money goes to Mike Tobin and to pay Mike Tobin's obligations, business obligations there.
Mr. Weigel, was there some pressure being brought by OLR or someone else that he close these several different trust accounts that he had?
That assertion has been made, and I guess I'd like to try to trace through some chronology, if I might, and I don't know don't expect that the court has the full record, each and every justice has the full record before her or him right now, but look at the explanations for why he closed the accounts. There's something, Exhibit 9. That's Mr. Tobin's letter to Travis Steeren, an OLR investigator, dated March 2nd of 2005. And after the fact letter, 6 months after he closed one account, a couple of months after another, he said, well, you know, I started phasing out the activity in this one account. He's talking about Wells Fargo then, back in 2002, a few years ago. And there hadn't been a transaction for 18 months. And I was waiting for 18 months for these things to clear. The inventory of checks was exhausted, et cetera. That was the reason that was proffered around early March. Now, toward middle of April, his letter of April 28th, Exhibit 11, he'll tell you, well, I closed the account because of the unclaimed property laws. And my office's purported pre-1980s conversation with Bapper. And because of my research into the unclaimed property laws and what Bapper had told, well, it changed from me to somebody in my office. It told somebody in my office 15 years before, you know, that's why I closed the account. And I believe that I was entitled to retain those fees as the reasonable fees and expenses of collection and trying to find people. I didn't segregate the money. I didn't make any effort to maintain the funds and trust account. I treated them as abandoned property and transferred them to my office account. Well, that's not the way unclaimed property law works, and the OLR called the administrator of the unclaimed property division, Mary Celentani, to testify. And you can't take your fees out of him, and he wasn't entitled to that money. So on May 27th, we get to Exhibit 14. He said, well, I closed the accounts in accordance with this office procedure. Procedure is I treat the property as abandoned, I'll mingle it with my own and use it, but I plan to resolve them after allowing a reasonable amount of time for these checks to clear. But he had already waited 18 months for these checks to clear before closing the account. That was one of the reasons a couple of months earlier he told our investigator that he had closed the account.
Counsel, just on the facts.
Then on October 1st, yes, he says, I did it because OLR told me to do it. But I'm sorry, Justice Bradley, but just a very small final answer to Justice Wilcox's question.
It was actually Justice Crooks.
Crooks's question.
Mine was a long time.
Both eminent. Eminent scholars.
let me interrupt her now, then.
Hope everybody had a great lunch today. I'm sorry, but the assertion was that OLR had maybe put on the pressure, brought up the heat in December of 04, January of 05. There was some testimony about closing the accounts, but one of the accounts, the Park Bank account, was closed in September of 04, even before that purported information came to Tobin. I mean, the explanations change and evolve and develop as the old explanations are debunked. That is why Mr. Tobin was found to have dissembled, to have made false material statements of facts to OLR during its investigation because of what he said. And he hadn't made any systemic effort to find those check holders before March of 2005. He later admitted that. And I apologize for jumping over your question, Justice Bradley.
No problem. Just for clarification, sometimes the stipulation and the arguments refer to unpaid checks, and Mr. Tobin's, they always refer to as uncashed checks. To me, there may be a difference. Uncashed, in my mind, has a stronger inference that they were all sent out. People have them, and they're just not cashing checks for some reason. Unpaid might mean that, you know, he's never sent them. Maybe they were issued or drawn up, or maybe not even that. So what is the status of it? Are these 18 checks, or whatever the number is, ones that were all sent out, and of the large number of checks that his office processes annually, these are some that people just didn't cash? Is that it?
My belief is that we're talking uncashed checks, as Mr. Kolb pointed out properly in his brief, and I might have called it smoke and mirrors, but it's very true. There's no evidence that Mr. Tobin ever failed to properly deliver initially at closing the checks to the people to whom the funds were entitled. These are checks which, for whatever reason, were not cashed and then accumulated and sat in his trust accounts. He knew, had an itemization and knew who the funds, at least originally, were delivered to. presumably as a default to whom they belonged, and then ultimately paid those funds to himself.
And your position is that what he should have done was make a list of all the payees and give it to the unclaimed fund?
He had a list of all the payees. He should have, and his office should have, investigated those matters. Attorney Tobin will say, well, I was investigating matters for years, for decades. Right, but not with regard to these checks. There had been no systemic effort with regard to the 18 checks in the Wells Fargo Trust account that was made at any time before March of 2005.
But if he had done what I just suggested, would OLR have prosecuted?
OLR's position is that if there are unclaimed or abandoned funds, and if they meet the statutory definition, which at the time was, I think, 5 years of dormancy, I believe the law has recently been changed to 3 years, then those funds would escheat to the unclaimed property division. In fact, we had testimony that we produced about the fairly low level of due diligence that a holder of those funds must perform in order to meet the standards of the unclaimed property law. You've got to send out a letter, basically, to a last known address. And that's almost all you would have to do before allowing them to escheat to the state. But even with this concept of escheat to the state in his mind, even with having done or purportedly done research on the unclaimed property law, he took the money and put it into his own pocket. And it was all money that he knew did not belong to him. That's our problem. That's kind of the nub of this. And Attorney Kolb at one point in his briefing said I want to show you what he said, but I want to make a quick statement, too. There's been some talk of whether red herrings or smoke and mirrors, and I'm not in any way accusing adverse counsel at all of being unethical, because I have tried cases and I have known Mr. Kolb for quite some time. He's a very conscientious and honest and worthy and effective adversary. But I think that the court knows that some of the effectiveness of defense attorneys can be to distract the focus from the matters at hand, and I want to bring the court's focus back to the fact that there was a dishonest conversion. And then the point that I was going to make is that Mr. Kolb mentioned in his final brief, well, there's 150 cases involving a 1.15, that's the trust account rule. Sanctions range from a private reprimand up to revocation. True. But if you do a compendium search, as I did a compendium search, with 20:1.15 and 8.4C, the dishonesty rule, you get 10 cases. 9 of those 10 were decided since 2001, and in every single one of those 9 cases, this court imposed a suspension of 6 months or more. Of those 9, there were, I believe, 5 revocation cases, 2-year suspension, a 1-year suspension, an 8-month suspension, and a 6-month suspension. And the 6-month suspension was just 2006. It was perhaps too late to cite in briefing to the court. I know I didn't cite it in my appellate briefs, but the court perhaps recalls it. It's the Scanlon case. And I didn't cite it because it's a 6-month case and because there's medical mitigation and there's a lot of different misconduct in some ways. But in Scanlon, the court might recall that your referee had recommended a suspension of under 6 months, and your referee did not find dishonesty, but did find, as Referee Inman found here, did find 1.15B violations that the attorney involved failed to hold the funds in trust. You know, and this court looked at that and said, no, I guess they said Scanlon's unauthorized conversion of his client's money to his own use is understood to be unlawful appropriation or misappropriation. And that commonly means to appropriate dishonestly. And we're going to find as a matter of law that this is dishonesty. And so even the Scanlon case is instructive in that this court found an important point to make and an important distinction when we have both 1.15 and alleged 8.4C dishonesty, as we do in this case.
Mr. Weigel, every case stands or falls on its facts, and these facts appear to be a little bit different from the facts in some of the other cases that were referenced, the 9 cases that you just referred to, in the sense that my recollection of the cases that we were involved with, that I was involved with and have reviewed, involves a clear-cut situation where you have an attorney that's going out of his way to, for lack of a better word, steal money. This case, and I don't think anybody's disputing that there's a conversion that takes place, as I understand it. But this case seems to be factually a little bit different, where we're dealing, it kind of reminds of the recent legislative move to try to claim some of these gift card monies for the state, with the banks arguing, well, it's really our money, when in fact it was purchased by a third party. And it kind of runs somewhere along those lines. And I'm wondering if, while legally there may be no distinction, if factually there's enough of a distinction to look at the cases a little bit differently. I'm not sure I get that same gut feel that you have somebody going out of their way to, quote, steal money, particularly when we're talking about the amounts that are involved. And I know you referenced that the $10,000 from the $3 billion that has passed through the account. I suppose the flip side of the argument, and I suppose the argument we'll hear from Mr. Cole, is that, look, if he wanted to steal and he's got $3 million to choose from, he's not going to take $10,000.
Well, a couple of points made, I believe, and I think that in response or to comment on those, it is more offensive to my gut that somebody would design to and steal money from a particular vulnerable little old person that I can look at and feel sympathy for and empathy for, then somebody would take uncashed checks that people didn't know they were entitled to, or the money from somebody who has a gift card, some, you know, corporate gift card or a corporation. But I think that it really it is, as far as the act, a distinction without a difference. You might have more of a visceral response to it. But the point is, you've got somebody, and OLR's point is, who looked at money, knew it wasn't his, and made the decision to put it in his pocket and use it. And yeah, every case is fact-intensive. I think that Mr. Kolb or myself or a bevy of other attorneys stand up in front of you in disciplinary cases and say every case must rise and fall on its own facts, and disciplinary cases are different, and that's a good thing. But lawyer regulation in Wisconsin is undeniably precedent-based, and what happens here with this appeal is OLR, an OLR director, does not want this case to stand for the proposition an attorney can dishonestly convert funds belonging to others that were entrusted to that attorney in his trust account and also dissemble to OLR and wind up with a suspension of less than 6 months, because an over-lenient result here is going to get thrown into the mix in every future case that the court has to think about misappropriation.
And now you threw out a new number, 6 months, over 6 months. Think that can be defended on the basis of our compendium and other cases?
Well, the OLR believes that the most appropriate response would be, the most appropriate level of discipline would be a 2-year suspension. I'm not going to change that. When I tried to cite the precedent in my brief, there were revocation cases cited. This is not a revocation case. Those are distinguishable. And there were 5 2-year suspension cases cited. Some of the most telling, either in terms of language or circumstances, are the Ward case, where the guy just set things up to convert the money but didn't actually convert the money. The Bolt case, where the court had a lot of language with regard to misappropriation. And the Edgar case, she converted thrice. The total was $11,000. She filed a false certification with the state bar. There are some parallels, you know, to that case as well. I mean, that is what the OLR is seeking. I guess that I can tell you very frankly that had there been a recommendation approaching that, that I wouldn't have recommended to my boss that we appeal on sanction. Whether I did or didn't is irrelevant, and I don't know that he would have decided to do so. Now, there's always going to be in a range of appropriate penalties, but there are certain benchmarks as well, between public and private, between reprimand and suspension, between a short suspension and a longer, between revocation and something different. And we felt that this was certainly a benchmark that wasn't being met, and that we saw this as a 2-year case and not a 90-day case plus 30 for the state bar failure to check boxes. No, not the 120-day case recommended by a referee who, as a trial judge, just did a spectacular job and made good findings and kept myself and Mr. Kolb in check. But you owe no deference to the 120-day recommendation. His credibility determinations, yes, he sat and sat through 2 days of trial and watched and listened to everybody that testified. Nothing that he found is clearly erroneous. That's my response to that, Chief Justice.
Thank you, Mr. Weigel. You will have 5 minutes in the rebuttal. Mr. Kolb, you represent Mr. Tobin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, I represent Michael Tobin, who incidentally had wanted to be here, but before we got the notice of the oral argument, he agreed to teach a seminar out of state and asked me if he should cancel that, and I said no, he should keep his commitment there. This is a trust fund case, and we realize that all trust fund cases have to be taken seriously. But as has been observed, there is a range of discipline imposed in trust account cases, and there probably every day of working day of the year is a trust account violation by an attorney in Wisconsin, most often of a technical nature and inadvertent nature. In order to assess what the appropriate sanction should be, you have to look at the mindset of the attorney. There are three kinds of categories, as I see it, of trust account violation cases. The first is theft, where the lawyer intends to steal from a client. We don't have that here. If this referee thought there had been theft, there is no way that he would have recommended 90 days with respect to the key allegation. Furthermore, I would submit that the OLR does not believe there was theft because they'd be seeking revocation if they felt that. On the other end is simple inadvertence, bank errors, transcription errors, putting into one account when it should have been in the other, and just a simple mistake. That's not the case here. Attorney Tobin made a conscious decision that was poorly reasoned, was wrong, was a violation, so we don't have that. The middle category, and that's where we are, is where there's bad judgment in the handling of trust funds. No evidence of predatory conduct or intent, no theft, no attempt to permanently deprive someone of their money. Attorney Tobin, as you know, is a real estate lawyer principally, an expert in real estate closings, with 26 years of experience, who has handled billions, with a B, of dollars of funds and closings, and has accounted for that to the penny with respect to every closing. There have been no prior complaints about his conduct. There have been no grievances filed. I don't know whether grievances are filed or not. There have been no grievances prosecuted. And there was no complaint, even in this case. No one complained. This developed because of a trust fund notification from a bank.
The council
determined that that was not a significant event. I'm sorry, I didn't.
But counsel, yeah, I wanted to give you an opportunity to finish. But isn't this a little bit different than just poor judgment? I mean, as I understood Mr. Tobin's position in the brief, even he acknowledges that this is not his money, and therefore he should not be taking this money. I understand the argument that he wasn't trying to take from particular clients, that this his belief that this was unclaimed and other things. But you still have to start with the premise that this money did not belong to him. And it sounds like the same type of argument the banks make. That's a separate issue with respect to the gift cards and whatnot. I mean, it's the big battle about whose money is it if it's not. It's in his account, and he can't identify who owns the money. Well, it seems to me to be a little bit more than just poor judgment to say, well, since the person's not coming forward, I'll just transfer it.
Well, by bad judgment, I don't mean to suggest just a calculation-type error. I mean, he shouldn't have done it this way. And I'll get to the time and questioning permitting. I'll get to the sequence that resulted in the action that he took. But I'm not here to say that he didn't violate the rule. But I am here to say that there was no bad intent, there was no predatory intent, and it falls in that middle area, as I see it, of these cases. There was no loss to clients, I might add. In assessing, it seems to me you look at both the conduct and the mindset that goes with the conduct. And in assessing that, I would hope that you would bear in mind several comments that were made by witnesses at this hearing. And let me digress for a second. I'm a little hard of hearing, so I was hearing myself. I didn't hear you. I apologize. And if in your questioning you could all speak up, that would be helpful. There were three different mortgage brokers and bankers who testified on his behalf, people who had used him for services for years. One of them, Kevin McBride, responded to questioning this way. Question, in the 300 to 400 closings, did you ever have cause for concern about Michael's handling of money? Answer, not once. Question, do you have an opinion about his honesty? Answer, I think he's one of the most honest people that I've met. Second broker, Mark Wakefield, Centurion Financial Group. Mike is very honest. I wouldn't be using Mike after 17 years if I didn't find him trustworthy. Third mortgage broker, Terrence Crowley. Question, do you intend to continue using him, understanding what you've seen in the complaint? Answer, absolutely I do. I wouldn't work with him if I didn't trust him. In addition to these three people who know his work intimately and use him for closings over and over again, entrusting their businesses to his hands, there was testimony from a gentleman who knows Attorney Tobin through Mr. Tobin's volunteer activities with his parish. A gentleman named Mark Heinen. Question was put to him, is this a man you would trust? Answer, unequivocally, absolutely. Another closing attorney said, I would trust him with my own money, my family's money. He has been scrupulous over the years in maintaining our accounts and in treating people right, basically. And then lastly, someone from his office saying, I trust him 100% implicitly. He's the most honest person I've ever met. All right. With that, by way of background, then what is it by way of conduct that resulted in the position we're in now? Well, it's basically three series of events. First is the accumulation of funds in these trust accounts. With respect to this, Attorney Tobin is blameless. He processed in these three accounts an estimated 70,000 checks worth $3 billion. There is no evidence, in response to the question, Justice Bradley, that you posed, that he ever failed to disperse funds from the closing to the proper party. Problem is that sometimes people don't cash the checks that they get. And this is an inevitable problem for institutions and businesses that handle large amounts of funds. That was testified to by Attorney Tobin, but also by Attorney Rebholz, and by one of the bankers who said, I'm sure the bank probably has thousands of those items, referring to unclaimed funds from uncashed checks. There's no evidence that the fact that these checks had gone uncashed was in any way the fault of Attorney Tobin. It's also clear that he maintained those funds in the trust account for years. When the time came when he closed the accounts, there were 18 checks and one of them remaining. But as he testified, that's 18 out of perhaps 50 that he had helped resolve over the period of time. So it is undeniable that he did make periodic efforts to determine where funds should go in cases where people didn't cash their checks. As I was rereading the decision by Mr. Ninneman, I thought, well, at the point where he says something to the effect of there were no serious efforts to locate recipients for these funds, I thought, well, this might be subject to misunderstanding because he had to have been referring to the 18 checks in the one account that remained at the time of the closing, because the evidence is undeniable that his office periodically made efforts to find who it was who had failed to cash the checks. That's by way of testimony, both Mr. Rebholz, Mr. Tobin. It's also by testimony of Mark Wakefield, and there are exhibits proving it. I'm not going to go into that, but it's recited at page 21 of our initial brief. So with respect to the first development of this problem, the accumulation of funds, I submit Attorney Tobin is blameless. In fact, he's his conduct was exemplary in terms of the handling of all of these closings. The second event was the closing of the trust accounts. And this started with, as I indicated, a out-of-trust notice from a bank. OLR investigated, found no problem. He had responded in a quick time, and it was an understandable event. But in the course of that, they came to realize that the software he was using for accounting, which is a standard commercial product called Quicken, when it got over $1 million, would not print out the numbers. It would show asterisks. It would calculate. The program would calculate properly. You could see it on the screen, but the printout would then show asterisks. So the OLR said to him, don't use this anymore. So he went out. He got another software program. It didn't work. Went out, got another one, and with the help of his brother, who knows more about computers, installed it. But they found that they could not transfer electronically the data from the Quicken program over to this new one, which I think was called QuickBooks. So what he decided was, all subsequent closings I'll handle through using the new software, and I'll clear out these other accounts that were on the Quicken program over time. So the problem came about when the OLR said stop using these old accounts. He concluded, as he testified, that if he couldn't write checks out of those accounts, he might as well close the accounts. And that's what he did.
Did the OLR say stop using those accounts?
Yes, yes.
That's evidenced in the record?
Yes. The problem, of course, is when he closes them, he no longer can treat these funds the way he had before, namely by allowing them to sit there. If somebody, after a period of time, you know, attempts to cash their check, their funds are there. So what did he do? He transferred the money to his general account. Mr. Weigel wants to say he transferred it to himself. I don't believe there's evidence of that. It went from the trust accounts to the general account, where it was used in the course of the business.
Was there a separate payroll account?
Pardon?
I'm sorry. Was there a separate payroll account for the firm?
My understanding is from the testimony was that the general operating account was a pass-through account. It was used to show disbursements and income. Any income then would go to other accounts for rent and payroll, et cetera. And so there was a separate ledger, I suppose, for the payroll account. And that's where the money eventually went to. Why did he do this?
In the same pot at the bank? Is there just one pot at the bank into which it was transferred?
Pardon me, Justice?
Was there just one pot at the bank, just one account into which dollars were put, this and others, and from that checks were written, sometimes for payroll, sometimes for other things?
I wish I knew. I think the answer to that is yes, but I don't know it as a factual matter.
Okay, thank you.
Why did the money go to the general account? I'd like to read to you from the transcript. Question. You testified in response to questions from Mr. Weigel. You admitted that when you took the money from the three trust accounts and put it in your operating account, that you thereby failed to hold those monies in trust. Am I correct in that? Answer, that's correct. Question. When did you come to that conclusion? Answer. After I received a letter from Mr. Stearin asserting that proposition. Parenthetically, Mr. Stearin is an employee of the OLR. Question. At the time you did it, did you feel like you were failing to hold money in trust? Answer, no. Question. What was your rationale, good or bad, bright or stupid? What was the rationale, the reason you had in mind why you were not taking money from trust? Answer. That the funds no longer represented trust funds because they were not processed by the person for whom they had been intended. Somehow they had been abandoned and needed to be recharacterized, and by recharacterized I mean reconfigured, and that would be done as a disbursement through our normal operating account. Now, was this good thinking? I don't think so. This, regardless of whether that money was abandoned, it wasn't his. So what he should have done is open another trust account, put the money there. He didn't do it. As I say, it was bad thinking, but it's not 2 years suspension bad thinking.
Counsel, in looking at the stipulation or partial stipulation of facts, number 35 says, as of January 19, 2005, Tobin's Associated Bank business account balance was $747.55, and Tobin's Associated Bank payroll account balance was $2,368.73. From that, I assumed there was a separate Associated Bank payroll account because, well, that's what I inferred from that stipulation of facts.
That could be. As I say, I had always assumed that it was a matter of a trust, rather of accounting. You have a ledger for payroll. You have a ledger for, you know, for rent disbursements, et cetera, but that it was one account. I don't know the answer, to be honest.
Since I'm speaking, I'll just continue one further question, and that is, what's to happen with this almost $10,000?
Much of it has been located to somebody who should get it and sent to them, and the rest is sitting in a trust account at the M&I Bank. Apropos, by the way, it's an important point, I think. When I say sent to the party to whom the funds are should go, it would be nice if it were as simple as you look at who the check was originally paid to and just give them another check. But more often than not, that person isn't the one who gets the funds. You know, there are all kinds of reasons why these checks can go uncashed. But one of the common ones, as probably all of you know from attending closings, the closer comes and has funds from the buyer's lender and has to issue a number of checks. One check to the seller's bank, another check to the seller, another check to a taxing authority, utilities, so on. And what can happen is somebody is sent a check, let's say a utility, and it turns out that somebody's already paid that bill. Maybe the seller, not understanding how this was going, paid it off. Maybe the buyer did. So it's often the case that the person who ultimately, if you did a kind of a schedule of following where the funds would go, would be entitled to it, isn't the person whose name is on the check. And that takes hours to figure out. Attorney Tobin gets, over the course of this time period, between $150 and $200 per closing. This extra work, you get nothing for. And it's work that he did on a periodic basis, but he was forced to do it not because of any fault of his, but because people who got checks didn't cash them.
Counselor, can't he just look in his check registry when he balances his checkbook and see there's a check to MG&E that's never been cashed?
And he did that. He did that on a monthly basis, and he had a schedule.
Well, but why wouldn't he know who was due the money?
Well, for the reason that I tried to explain, that I mean, first consider the first 30 days after the transaction, if a check hasn't cleared, you don't do anything because
right.
You know, people put it aside.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what we don't have evidence of how long you know
sure.
they would wait. But suppose after 120 days, you say, okay, what's this all about? He testified that where there are large amounts, or whether it's for a purpose that would cause somebody some harm, for example, paying for title insurance, he would do it right away. Otherwise, he kept the list, and he knew the payees. But the problem is it's not as simple as just getting in touch with the payee. We had some extensive testimony on an example case where he had to go to different parties, each of whom saying, no, it's not me. So you don't know who it is, ultimately, who has that money coming to them. And we have checks here, some of which were 8 years old.
So it's either going to be the bank, if you're doing a real estate closing, or it's the buyer who's already been charged by the bank for the money. I mean, what other choices would there be if, say, the check to MG&E isn't cashed?
Well, it could be the person, it could be the entity or person to whom the check was made out. They might have lost it.
Mm-hmm.
It could be the seller who paid the obligation that was otherwise going to be paid out of the closing.
Okay.
It could be the buyer who did the same thing.
Right.
It could be some other entity, a title insurance company paying off a small lien in order for the policy to issue. It could be a number of, mm-hmm. of people, entities. You don't know just from the face, but he did.
But for sure he knew it wasn't his money.
He did.
So that's where the clinker is here.
Yeah, I agree. That is where the clinker is. But, you know, keep in mind that at some point, money that's held in trust is no longer trust money because it escheats to the state. I mean, at that point, it's not trust money.
That's not, it's still not his, though.
It's not his. He testified, to my way of thinking, credibly. First of all, he maintained schedules of the checks in all three accounts, and it was his intention, again, over the course of time, with these periodic reviews, if he found somebody to whom the money should go, they'd get it. But because he concluded, not correctly, but concluded, it's not trust money anymore, I can pay them out of my general account. If he had intended to somehow steal or cheat, and this was an observation I think Justice Butler made. He was already under investigation by the OLR because of the initial trust account notification and because they wanted him to change his accounting software. Why in the world would he take money from the very accounts that they were looking at? He had other funds available to him to meet business expenses. He testified to that. He showed that to the OLR in a communication. You have to remember, a small one- or two-person firm, you know, they're not building up huge amounts in the checking account. You get the money if you pay off payroll. If you're the principal and you got some extra, you pay yourself. So you're always near zero. And as he said, he was the funding source for his firm. If money needed to be put in, he'd put it in. And he did have money. So he didn't have the motive here to take this money improperly. He didn't do this right. But I think intent and mindset is critical. Shortly before one of these accounts was closed, there was evidence that he took and transferred over $2,000 from his operating account into the trust account. Why? Because one of the lenders had underfunded the closing and refused to make good on it, so he covered it. This is inconsistent with the theme of somebody, you know, seizing money for bad motive. I'm not denying he made a bad call, but I am denying that it was a bad motive. Finally, you know, these funds, if he wanted to steal money, it would have been so easy to do. These funds had gone unclaimed for years. No one was going to come forward. He could have just made a bookkeeping entries, you know, paid. There is no intent to steal here. That's why I say this does fall in the bad judgment category. He should have taken the money, put it into a trust account, or, as Justice Abramson said, he should have sent the check to the state. We wouldn't be here. But bear in mind that he performed his duties as a trustee with respect to these closings fully. He received the funds. He issued checks per the instructions that he was given. He held the funds for years in the bank, even though other people had failed to cash the checks. And he continued to keep track of the money after he closed the accounts.
Our order very well may touch upon that $10,000, which you are advising us now really isn't close to $10,000. I heard your response to my question to be that, well, since this has all started, maybe since August 1, 2005, he's replaced or found some of these folks. What are we supposed to do, if anything, regarding this approximately $10,000 in our order. Anything? Address it?
Well, you know, this problem came before this court once before in the Kalal case. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but that's 286 Wiz Second 10. There's a question, what do you do with unclaimed funds? And basically what this court said was, go ask the OLR.
Now, well, I'm asking you.
In that regard, I would note that, Mary Hafe Smith, the trust account, I don't know, the title supervisor or the main trust account person at the OLR, when asked during these proceedings about handling of unclaimed funds, stated, quote, she would not have been at liberty to give advice on that to an attorney, end quote. This is an area that is unclear how you handle it.
The issue really arises because the court is committed to restitution. So I would say that another way of phrasing Justice Bradley's question is saying, how do we arrange for restitution to the people who are to get this money when we don't know who they are? You say you don't know who they are, and then it would take a lot of work to figure out who they are. Do we just distribute it to the state and let the state figure it out?
I think that's my answer, but I'm not totally certain in it. I mean, I think that's probably the most efficient way. It's you know, he's found some of these people. I don't know. I haven't talked to him on this point lately, whether he's figured out anybody else lately. But my sense is that probably what remains at the M&I Bank is money that he just can't figure out where it goes. And that probably should just be to the state.
We say, in light of that, do we say, well, when you can't get back in until everybody's paid off?
I don't think that would be fair because he may not be able to determine. Connect it back in until you have either paid it out or stated to the state. Yeah, I mean, that we could do that in a matter of days.
When you say this, that $10,000 was put into a bank, he's paid that back, you're saying?
Yes, he took the money,
right.
Put it into trust. Some of it has since been paid out to recipients.
Anyway, the money that he took, put into his own accounts, personal accounts, have now been paid back into a fund.
Yes.
And from that fund, some monies have been paid to people who own it, right?
Yes.
Okay. And then there's some left over, and you don't know if you can find these other people. Okay. But the money is not his anymore. In a way, he's made restitution, but to an unknown number and an unknown named, not named people. Okay.
The other case I'd ask you to consider here, and I see my time is running low, is the Raymond case. He was also a real estate closer. There was a $100,000 discrepancy in his trust fund, unaccounted for, and he had allowed $38,000 to be taken out of that trust account over time to pay bank charges. He was given a 3-month suspension. Why? I don't know. The case law from this court is often not particularly detailed on your thinking about sanctions. But I have to believe that it goes to this question of an assessment of what the mindset of the attorney was. And in this case, I think that the facts and the case law would support a reprimand or a modest suspension of Attorney Tobin.
But less than the one that the referee gave.
Yes, I think that, for example, that by tacking on the extra 30 days to make it 4 months, with all due respect for Mr. Ninman, who, as Mr. Weigel said, did a wonderful job at the hearing, the fact of the matter is that there was no finding of a failure to maintain proper trust accounts. In light of that, the annual certifications, he identified all of his trust accounts, and he maintained them all, and to tack on 30-day suspension because he failed to check one of the little boxes at the end seems to me to be disproportionate.
Thank you, Mr. Cole. Mr. Weigel?
Thank you.
Thank you, Chief. I find that I have maybe 8, 9, 10 things I'd like to tell you all, and I'm mindful of the fact that I have 300 seconds to do it. Of course, I sat down on the yellow earlier, but I have the feeling that's not going to get me a lot. I'll try to get to it. If banks have thousands of outstanding uncashed checks, I doubt what I would want to hear or any auditor would want to hear as well, you know, so we just put them in our pocket and we spent it because they're uncashed and we're not sure if they're who they belong to anymore. It would not be the right response for a fiduciary such as a bank. That was not the response for a fiduciary such as Attorney Tobin. As to the accumulation of funds and the submission by counsel that Attorney Tobin is blameless, that's directly contrary to what Referee Nenneman stated. It's clear that no serious effort was made by Tobin to locate the proper payee and resolve these matters prior to the closing of three trust accounts. His statements to OLR suggesting the contrary are not true. The delay in addressing this problem and the passage of time with respect to these matters are really the result of Tobin's failure to address this subject years earlier. That's the referee's report, page 12, various lines, is cited on page 8 of OLR's brief in chief, the blue brief. Mr. Tobin found that the funds were abandoned and needed to be recharacterized, and he recharacterized them as his own, to his own uses. There were different accounts. There were absolutely different accounts. It's throughout all of the exhibits and the stipulation and the information. And the OLR pointed out, I believe the chronological recitation is on page 6 of my gray brief, the combined brief, the first portion, what all happened on that particular day in 2005 when the money flowed from the trust account into the form of a check payable to Tobin, into his business account, out of his business account, into the payroll account, which, by the way, had less than $200 in it prior to that deposit, out of the payroll account to Mr. Tobin and to his purposes. All of that is matters of record. The January 2005 business and payroll account statements, separate accounts, are Exhibit 6 and 7. There is a point perhaps being made, well, there was no need to steal. This guy had money, or there's no need to steal this particular money. He could have stolen other money.
I don't think he's arguing he could have stolen other money, Counselor.
That was perhaps as I was characterizing and maybe mischaracterizing some of what Justice Butler had said. And, you know, again, there are a lot of, how can I put it, when Winona Ryder probably did not have a financial need to go into a store and shoplift in Beverly Hills. You know, there are a lot of people, good people, people who are thought to have the highest moral character, and rightfully so in some aspects of their life, who choose to make bad actions. You know, this property was just simply property that belonged to others, and Tobin was a fiduciary, and he took it. And the fact that he did not need $10,000 or could have done that in another manner had he chosen does not negate the fact that he converted this particular $10,000. And is it sitting in trust now except for what he's been able to divvy out? Yeah, in August of 2005, many months after this happened, after all of the explanations to the OLR, after all of the letters and the investigative letters and the representations and misrepresentations, he did place money back into trust. But when I say place money back into trust, it's not like that was ever segregated. There was a pointing out that on a certain day, as recited in number 35 of the stipulation, that there's a certain amount in the payroll account and a certain amount in the business account that totaled $2,000, $3,000. The money was never segregated. That $10,000 wasn't placed into a separate trust account or sitting in the business account or just waiting to figure out what to do with it. He took it, he put it into his own accounts, and he used it. That is the bad motive. That is the bad intent. That is why OLR has consistently pursued a 2-year suspension in this case.
Now, on the 2-year suspension, and looking at your compendium, I think you went through that before, but I was, just give that to me again based on where this is in relation to what others have done.
Well, I would submit that the closest cases, my red light just went on.
You may finish.
The closest cases that OLR cited in its brief with regard to that would, in certain respects, respectively, would be the Ward and Bolt and Edgar matters, each of which involved a two-year suspension.
And Bolt, I remember, he took $55,000. And he converted it to his own use in the sense he paid off some of his own bills. And you're saying, well, that the same thing was done here with just a lesser amount.
Took $10,000 and converted it to his own use and paid off his bills. But in Bolt, the court found the conduct was mitigated because this was an estate matter. It was subject to an accounting. And the court found the fact that Attorney Bolt knew he would ultimately have to account for the funds is a mitigating factor in the fact that he attempted to make the clients whole. And so they said, well, you know, we're not going to take the referee's 90-day recommendation here in Bolt. I'm not sure that that was the referee's recommendation. Strike that. They decided that this is not a revocation case necessarily. There was some mitigation involved. But I think that some of the language the court used in that case is pertinent to and a fair consideration when you decide what you want this case to say.
Thank you, Mr. Weigel. Thank you, Mr. Kolb, in discussing with us today the appropriateness of the sanction, not challenging the findings of the referee. These cases are always difficult, and we appreciate both your arguments today. We are now adjourned for the January sitting. I'm going to just change the process a bit today. We'll see how it works. I'm going to ask the court to reconvene in the conference room immediately, and then we'll take a break after we handle the first matter, which will be this matter. We're adjourned. Colleen?